worry, no sweets. Only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school. My household smell like soul food, bro. Curry food.
What's up, Beardos? Welcome to episode 17 of The Bearded Vegans. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes on The Commentist Network, which can be found at thecommentist.com. And you can reach us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com or commenting on our Instagram at thebeardedvegans.
In today's episode, we will find out where in the world Andy is, go over some vegan news, ask the question, when it comes to vegan advocacy, do the ends justify the means, and conclude with an interview with vegan powerlifter and co-host of the Rise and Resist podcast, Holly Knoll. So, Andy, for some reason in my headphones, I'm hearing like a echo. Let me just take off my headphones and try saying something.
Hello?
Oh, you're right. Oh, Andy's right in front of me, everybody. Oh, yeah. So, Andy, where are you?
I am literally right in front of you right now.
So what has been going on? It's very exciting. This is the first time I've seen Andy in months.
I think 2.5 months since I left the great Northeast.
Yes. How was your 20-hour drive back to Connecticut?
It was long. It was filled with some hot-boiled peanuts, which, have you ever had hot-boiled peanuts?
I have not.
They're a southern delicacy. Hmm. It sounds gross, and it's delicious. It's just like these peanuts in the shell that have been boiled until they're the consistency of, like, mashed potatoes or something.
And do you eat the shell?
No, you crack open the shell, and then you suck out the peanut. And
Is it just like peanut butter at that point?
It's a little more firm. Huh. And you can get regular or you can get Cajun, so.
That sounds pretty good, actually.
Yeah, it's quite salty, but so I left Florida, and before I did that, I did take a day trip to Gainesville, which is my, I think, favorite food town in Florida, at least, and I went to Wild Iris, which is Florida's only feminist bookshop, which was pretty cool.
Cool.
And they had Jean Bauer's book in there from Farm Sanctuary, and they had a book called Food Pets Die For, which is all about how horrible the pet food industry is. So it was cool to see things of that nature in there as well. But more importantly, went to Reggae Shack, which is easily in my top five restaurants of all time.
I've heard Andy talk about it an incredible amount of times.
we were in there, and I went to the bathroom, and the waitress came up to Amanda and was like, "Oh, have you been here before?" And Amanda was like, "Oh yeah, like the other guy, like he loves this place, and he ate here a bunch at Fest." And the woman was like, "Yeah, people come. There was one guy who ate here three times at Fest in one day," and I was like, "That might have been me." But there was one time where I ate there twice in one day. And then, like, me and my friend went to Karma Cream to get a nice scoop of vegan ice cream, which we did also go to on this trip. And then on the walk back, I was like, "Oh, I got to go use the bathroom." And I walked back into Reggae Shack. And they're like, "Oh, you're back." So that may have been the time.
That's awesome.
But anyway, Reggae Shack's awesome. Get the brown stew tofu if you are ever in the area. Or even if you're not in the area, you should go there. And then, yeah, the drive Florida to Connecticut was done in a 14-hour and an 8-hour chunk. And I
disgusting.
I love to drive, but yeah, it's a, you know, 14 hours is a bit much. But and I made no fun stops on the first day. Second day, I circumvented DC, Baltimore, Philly, New York City, and I went to a little town called Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
And what's in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania?
It's a little place known as Vegan Treats, which is sort of the ultimate vegan bakery. They win all sorts of awards. If anyone listening hasn't heard of them, they do great desserts. They taste great, but so they have a lot of really fun looking, just impeccable looking desserts. And I tried to go to Cali Burrito, which has this amazing smoked tofu, and I pulled up and there was a sign saying that they had a fire and.
Oh, no.
That they were renovating. So that was
a little too smoked.
I guess so. so that was cool. I picked up some treats for people and for Amber, who cuts my hair, which is my first stop. Because as you know, I hate small talk. So I couldn't go to any barber. I had to go to my friend Amber as soon as I got home.
Nice.
So yeah, so that's all that's worth mentioning in the food world. And Paul, I unfortunately missed your band, Continuous Improvement, also podcast by the same name on the Commentist Network, open for Andrew WK.
Yes.
So my question is, did you get him to go vegan yet?
I have not. I did not get a chance to talk to him, unfortunately. I've talked to him a bunch of times in the past, but not this time. He kind of just showed up, played, and then walked out. Although it was at this very small venue called The Space. So there wasn't too many places for him to hang out backstage. I don't even know if there is a backstage. He kind of just walked down the side stairs where the bathroom is when he came out. So I probably could have slipped him a couple pamphlets, but it didn't come up, unfortunately.
Next time.
I did give you a shout out though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw you were wearing one of my shirts.
Yep.
But I didn't find any pictures that weren't blurry because you're always jumping around. But yeah. Well, he seems like someone that's sort of primed to go vegan.
For the listeners out there, I know a lot about Andrew WK. But only last year he actually said something just off the cuff that said that he used to be vegan for a year or two or something like that. Now he's not vegan anymore.
Ex-vegan, huh?
Yep, I know. Ugh,
that's going to be a future show topic.
Should you still support Andrew WK?
All right, well.
On that sour note.
On that sour note, let's go to something positive. Our first and only vegan news item followed to something we've talked about a few times in the past, and that is that the FDA has decided that vegan just mayo is actually mayo after all. Cue party noise. Not a whole lot to talk about here, but something that I think was very interesting is that they had talks with the FDA, and basically they're just going to change their labeling a little bit to just really emphasize that it's vegan. And
keep going.
How dare you, Paul? From the article on theqz.com. And as always, every article we discuss will be posted on the show notes at thecommentist.com. From that article, the new label clearly states that Just Mayo does not contain eggs, and CEO Josh Tetrick tells Quartz it will emphasize the word just, not as in only, but as in guided by reason, justice, and fairness.
Oh my God, is that why it's called Just Mayo?
How awesome is that?
Is that why it's... That's what it means?
I don't know if, I had the same reaction when I read that. I was just like, oh my God, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
I don't know if they were just like, crap, we got to figure this out and give it a new meaning. But on that article, they have a little mock-up of what the label is going to look like. And the word just is larger, and there's a little kind of tag printed on tag hanging down that says the definition of just to really emphasize that. And
yeah,
it just,
wait, it says quote the definition of just, or it says what the definition of just is.
It says just like the dictionary thing, like okay, just definition.
I thought you meant it said literally it said the definition of this mayonnaise is the definition of just.
And the new packaging came out and their sales plummeted. So yeah, that was really cool. That's a cool victory for Hampton Creek and Josh Tetrick. So
yeah,
kudos to them.
I bet you that's what it always meant, and people just didn't really realize it. Like I didn't. Maybe people did realize it. Maybe we were the only people that didn't realize it. But thinking back on it, just mayo, it doesn't really make sense as a name when you think about it as only mayo.
Well, I think it was just kind of meant to be like they were trying to target a market that's like, food has all these weird things in it, and you want something that doesn't have all this and that, and so this is simply mayonnaise or mayo. But I wouldn't be surprised if that went into their thinking, and they just never chose to explain it as such until now. But I think it's awesome.
Yeah, no, it is. That makes me want it even more now. My righteous mayo.
Just about to fill a bathtub full of just mayo and dive right in, Scrooge McDuck it all around.
Yep, yep. So we didn't have this plan, but Andy, you had sent me something that I still need to do, something about the Ben & Jerry's ice cream, right? They're coming out.
Yeah, you better jump on that, Paul. I put in the address, which is my current mailing address, which is just my parents' house, where I'm about to be leaving in 2 weeks. So I don't know if I'm going to be able to actually get it. But Ben and Jerry sent out an email saying, we want you to be, you know, one of the first people to taste test our new thing. And that was not like a special thing for me. It's just I've been on their email alerts, or as they call it, chunk mail, appetizing. And I don't know if each email had an individual code or something, but you just put in your thing and it, your address, and it's like, hey, look out, in the next coming weeks, you're going to get something in the mail. So I don't know if they're going to ship an ice pack with a pint of ice cream or a half pint or what, but it seems like it's on the horizon.
And it does say, if you want in, click the button below and provide us with your address before December 21st. So I still have time.
Yeah.
Because it's currently December 17th.
So anyway, so that's coming down the pike, and one of us will get it as long as Paul fills this thing out. And my parents will try it. I'll have them come to a guest spot.
Or I'll just
spot.
Drive to your parents and
there you go.
Steal. I'll wait outside every day for the mail.
Plan a heist.
Yep. So that's exciting too. Two good things in the news, which is good.
Two good news, and now cue dramatic, sad music. It's time to talk about our question of the week. And what is the question, Paul?
When it comes to vegan advocacy, do the ends justify the means?
And so this definitely relates to a lot of things that we've talked about before, and we have sort of two big articles that we want to draw into this discussion, which I think they have topics that expand well beyond this question, but hopefully that question's a good place to get us started. Mm-hmm. So the thing that is sort of timely is that there's been a big hubbub, an outrage about comments that Durian Ryder has made recently regarding domestic abuse. And for anyone not familiar with Durian Ryder, you can just go ahead and never think about him ever again, because you're just going to get upset. Yeah. But basically, the short of it is that there was someone who posted pictures of themselves after having been physically assaulted by their partner, and Durian said that it was their fault for not leaving. It was 100% their fault, and used some other choice language as well. And we don't really talk about Durian or Freely or some of those people. We kind of touch on them a little bit. We talk about the vegan bros, who I don't think are anything close to Durian in terms of horribleness, despite the fact that they said some horrible things. But this incident was the springboard for an article at dailylife.com by Ruby Hamad, I think I'm pronouncing that right, titled, "When is Being Vegan No Longer About Ethical Living?" So do you want to sort of start us off on summarizing the article?
So yeah, the author basically talks about this terrible thing that Durian said, and how him and his partner, who's known as Freely the Banana Girl, their vegan advocacy, if you would call it that, because it's a lot of like health advocacy, is based on fat shaming, and for instance, they use a quote that says, Freely frequently claims that she just has to speak up when she sees people abusing themselves via the fork. So the article's going into like this idea about how these vegan, like, I guess you would call them celebrities. I'm not exactly sure like their absolute popularity statistics, but I would say that they are very, very popular.
They're quite popular. Yeah. Enough that things like this make it into the news, and why Durian is commenting on this thing that doesn't seem to have anything to do with the vegan community.
Yeah.
Just felt like stirring up some shit, or just, you know, renewing his turd card or something. But
but one of the main points that the author's making is, and this is a quote, it says, "Unfortunately, mainstream veganism is not always a safe place for people of color, feminist women, the disabled, and those who don't fit the conventional model of attractiveness." And she goes on, she mentions Gary Yourofsky, who we've discussed before, and just how these mainstream vegan celebrities just get so much popularity, and even if they're, because of what they do for the animals, even if they're doing all these horrible other things or making the vegan community not a safe place for the majority of, it mentions, it says how in a movement that is made up of, comprised mostly of women, it's mostly white men who are in leadership positions. She goes on about that too. So it's just how, this the vegan community has turned into something that is just basically like a white male middle class type movement, and everyone else kind of gets pushed out of the forefront.
Yeah, big old steamroller going over a lot of people and people that make up the majority of the world, in fact.
Yeah.
So, and another quote from the article is that veganism is growing. That is a good thing. What isn't good is that as the community grows, so too does its disregard for anyone who isn't an able-bodied middle-class white person. In this myopic interpretation of veganism, there is no valid option to being hot and skinny. Obesity, along with cancer and even mental illness, are callously blamed on the failure to, quote, carb the fuck up on a vegan diet, and little sympathy is granted to anyone who doesn't heed their message. So, it's a whole lot of ugliness riding high off the coattails of that Just Mayo victory. But What do you make of all of this?
I think, because we've talked about this kind of stuff before, and I think one thing that we necessarily don't always talk about is like what we can do about it besides just being like, hey, stop saying these terrible things. So I think in our podcast, we've talked a lot about this issue before, about the horrible things that people have said, and we've kind of given the suggestions of like, hey, stop saying these things. But I think that the author kind of summarizes, and another important note that maybe we've kind of like said it before, but I think it's important to reiterate. It says at the end of the article, the acceptance of veganism into the broader social justice movement hinges on bridging this gap, and no one is better placed to do so than those vegans who are most marginalized in society. People of color, women, LGBTI, fat people, disabled people. Indeed, many, such as Sista vegan creator A. Breeze Harper, disability advocate and artist Sonara Taylor, sorry if I butcher that name, and eco-feminist pioneer Carol Adams already are. So I think one thing that's important is that instead of, as the article mentions previously, instead of elevating white men into the leadership positions of the vegan movement, we kind of need to push other non-white men into the forefront. And what better way to do so than creating a podcast of two white men? But no, I think that's what we can start doing, us two white guys. We can start doing is like promoting vegans of color, vegan women, and other people that aren't white and male.
Yeah, yeah, it's actually something that I always kind of struggle with, because like, does the world need another two white guys like talking about this stuff? Unfortunately, we know that, you know, just by virtue of who we are, we're sort of going to be seen as more of an authority on these things, even if someone knows way more about this issue but isn't a white man. So I hope that in that regard that our voices can help reach our people. And I think that's like, if there's any job of quote unquote allies, it's to be doing the educating of our people, and our people are the white men. And I know there's plenty of people who aren't that listening to the podcast, but hopefully that can be the role. And I think you hit the nail on the head, and that's like, okay, we can make all these posts and podcasts calling out these people and critiquing what they have to say, which I think is important. But yeah, more than that, elevate the voices of marginalized people. And, you know, there's like a project, Black Vegans Rock. And I remember posting a link. There's like a list of 100 black vegans that rock. And, you know, people are like, why just the black vegans? And it's just like just the fact that you're asking that question sort of validates the fact that it needs to be made.
Yeah, because I think it's easy for like a white vegan to be like, well, like these people are the forerunners of the vegan community because they're doing they're like the best that the vegan community has to offer, or like they're the ones that are doing the most and stuff like that. When it's important, I think, as white vegans to promote, to say like, hey, this is not like, it's not that there's more, or it's not that the white vegans are doing a better job. It's just that they're the ones that are going to get the exposure, and they're the ones that are going to get like the praise for it.
Yeah. They're the ones that society is sort of set up to promote at least more easily and, mm-hmm. and more prominently than other people in society. So, pretty lofty things to be thinking about, and it's hard to feel like we have all the answers to this stuff, yeah. But I think talking about it is a good place to start, yeah. And obviously we are not the first people to ever talk about it, and all these things have certainly been said much more eloquently by mm-hmm. the people that are actually directly affected by these issues, but hopefully this is something that people are going to be thinking about in terms of which voices they choose to repost from and elevate and give that sort of celebrity status.
And I think we should tie this back into our original question, which is, do the ends justify the means? So let's tie that back into that, because I think for every like white male that's leading the vegan movement, and that someone has said, oh, well, this person did something really shitty, but they're a really great vegan advocate, there are 100 other either vegans of color or vegan women or vegans in the LGBTI movement that would be doing the exact same thing as this person, but also not doing real shitty things. So I think I would say, to answer, if I am going to throw out a preliminary answer to the question, it's going to be no, they don't justify the means, because there's going to be another person that could do the exact same thing for the animals, but won't have the kind of like negative impact that some of these vegan celebrities have, or I don't want to call them celebrities, but vegan, like the popular people in the vegan community.
Yeah. I think it's safe to call them vegan celebrities. So that kind of knocks them down a peg.
Well, the only reason I would call Durian and Freely, those I would call vegan celebrities, but like Gary Yourofsky, he's not like a, I feel like he doesn't have anything to do with like the entertainment business.
Yeah, he's like a figurehead.
Yeah,
or I don't even want to use the term leader.
But I didn't want to use the word celebrity, because that's who we're talking about too. We're not just talking about like the Durian and those people that are not just about like vegan advocacy. Like we're also talking about the Gary Yourofskys of the world that are just all about vegan advocacy. But again, like there are other people who could be doing the same thing as him, and then who are doing the same thing as him, but without the kind of negative drawbacks.
To the question, do the ends justify the means, in terms of, well, this person is problematic in this way, but they do good work for animals. And so I think maybe in some ways or many ways that's short-sighted, because let's examine what the ends are. And most people, I'm assuming, are thinking, well, the ends are they're making all these vegans, so that's good. But if strategically you want to think about it, well, if you want everyone to go vegan, or as many people as possible, then you need to be doing things that are drawing in these other folks. And it's like, okay, you could get every single white male to go vegan, but where do you go from there if you've just sort of cast out these huge segments of the population? So even if you don't want to think about it from like a compassionate, be a good person perspective, yeah. Like look at it from your own definition, look at it from your own goals, which is save as many animals as possible, spare as much suffering as possible. You're not going to achieve that if you're not incorporating these other issues, or at least taking them into account in your advocacy. So that's like something to think about is like, are the ends really what you think the ends are? Are you actually getting everyone to go vegan, or are you just getting a small amount or a certain segment of the population to go vegan?
And like, while you're getting these people to go vegan, are you also instilling, like, real shitty, like, philosophies into them while you're doing it? So now you're, are you then now creating people that have these same, the same ideology as you and are just going to keep being shitty in other regards? Because, I mean, we, it's like, while our, while this podcast is about veganism, it's like, I think we've made it clear that we don't, that's not the only thing that we care about.
Yeah. And actually the closing remarks on this article are, any vegan who thinks animal liberation can be achieved without addressing human oppression is kidding themselves. You cannot end an injustice by replicating the conditions that created it. So, and this kind of goes to the notion that people like Yourofsky will say that, well, once you get somebody to go vegan, that erases all the other things. Because if they think it's wrong to harm an ant, then obviously they're going to think it's wrong to be racist, even though he then goes and proves that totally wrong. But it's like, yeah, you're not going to cure all of society's ills by getting every single person to go vegan, even though it will address a huge number of issues. It's not really going to lessen the human suffering, and it's just going to continue to perpetuate all this horrible shit that's going on if you don't address those things.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, it's like, we've talked about this before, but basically I think it comes down to the point that, like, just because you go vegan doesn't mean that you're a good person. Mm-hmm. And I know that we, like, tend to kind of rag on veganism a lot. I feel like our show is not Vegan 101, you know? It's like, hopefully this, we've had lots of great emails from people saying this show has helped them go vegan, but often I feel like this is for people that are kind of...
grad school vegan.
Yeah, grad school vegan.
Not that I'm really one to be delivering that, but...
There's this notion, and I know I certainly fell prey to it, of if someone's vegan, they're a good person. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely, that's not the case. You know, if you go vegan, there's still all these other things to work on. And again, from a strategic standpoint, if you want to make as many new vegans as possible or open people up to it, you need to be considering all these other things. And that ties in actually to a quote in the article that I love.
Yeah.
And is, I think, a super interesting nut to crack open. And that is, what sets veganism apart from other movements is that it is the only one that advocates on behalf of a group that cannot speak for itself. It makes it even easier. And that makes it even easier for wider society to ignore. And so the article is not centered around this notion at all, but the idea that certain people might be drawn to this movement because they don't have to answer for their actions, in the same way that a white person joining an anti-racist movement would if they're advocating in a way that those who are affected don't like.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say, that it basically, the fact that, like the quote says, that it's, you're advocating for a group that can't speak for themselves, it makes it so that people like Yourofsky can say, like, I'm doing the best thing for animals, and, like, the animals will, like, appreciate what I'm doing, when, like, I don't know, it's like, he has no way of validating that claim. And I guess he can look at, like, statistics and say, look, I've made this many vegans, blah, 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 blah. But again, we're trying to not look at being vegan or going vegan as, like, as it's this own isolated issue.
Yeah. As more than the end point, it's a means to an end. It's this, a stepping stone on a greater path.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that quote was a nice quote.
Yeah. And I don't think that a lot of people that join the movement are, like, consciously thinking about that, but I think it makes this movement a place that is, like, safer for those that just want to be able to speak on behalf of others, savior complex or whatever. It, like, gives them a safer place to do it, where they're not really going to have to answer to those that they're advocating for. Even though we know there's plenty of infighting within the community, and everyone thinks that they have the best idea and the best way to do this. So that fighting does happen, but people can always just fall back on, like, well, I'm accountable to the animals. I'm not accountable to the humans that I'm affecting.
Yeah.
Which is, does the ends justify the means, right there.
Yep.
And so continuing that train of thought of, like, Do the Ends Justify the Means? There was an article also on theqz.com, today's sponsor, written actually by Ingrid Newkirk of PETA, and the title is, PETA, our tactics may be shocking and in your face, but they yield results. So that kind of opens it up into the wider picture. And, you know, Ingrid sort of goes to outline the early successes that PETA has had, and then goes on to say, our guiding philosophy is that silence is a social cause's worst enemy. Whatever we have to do to break that silence and bring the topic into the arena of public discussion, we will try. In a world with 140 character attention span, provocative campaigns make the difference between allowing important yet depressing subjects to remain invisible and have them widely seen. The public is more interested in hearing about the Kardashians than about the animals who are cut up in laboratories and classrooms. Experience has taught us that colorful and controversial gimmicks like stripping to bare skin rather than wear skin grab headlines, bringing a serious message to audiences around the country and often even the whole world. So that's basically just saying, you know, Ingrid saying, no matter what our tactics are, if they yield animal liberation, then they're getting the goods.
And she doesn't like, she doesn't, and I wouldn't expect her to, but she does not in the article address like specific accusations. Like she never says like, we're not sexist because this, we're not racist because this. She just kind of says, like you mentioned, like whatever we do is okay because we're like doing it for the animals. So
just scary.
Yeah.
That's like a really scary notion to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, when I was, cause when you're reading this, and obviously it's written by the president of PETA, so it's going to make them sound really good. When you're reading it, you're like, oh wow, they have done a lot of stuff, and it kind of, I mean, this is the point of her writing it. So I guess it was slightly successful if it got me thinking like, oh wow, they have done a lot of stuff. Like, do the ends justify the means? I don't know. Let's talk about it with Andy later. But you want to think like, you want to be like, well, you know, it's like not all of like, they're not every single thing that they do is not like problematic. Would you agree with that? Like they are able to do things that are not problematic, not necessarily saying that they're effective, but would you agree with that?
Begrudgingly.
So when I'm reading this, I'm like, well, like the picture is, like the picture that they're using as the headline is two guys in India, I believe, and they're wearing like biohazard suits, and it just says meat is a biohazard, go vegan. And it's like, they include that picture, and the title is like, our tactics may be shocking and in your face. Like, that's not really, like, a shocking and in-your-face thing.
We covered a human body in a hazmat suit. Whoa!
So it's like...
They're wearing bikini. They're naked underneath.
So it's like... I don't know. I guess I don't know enough about PETA to have, like, a list of every different thing, every different type of activism or protest that they've ever done before. But you would think that there'd be a lengthy list of things that most people would deem like non-problematic. And I wouldn't...
Would you say most people or most vegans?
Most... Wait, why?
I mean, I feel like a lot of their victories would be okay with vegans, but not the general population.
So do you think that they're... Do you think that... Let me clarify what you're saying, that most of the people that are calling them out are not vegan, for calling them out for being like sexist and racist and stuff like that.
Well, so PETA is such a special situation because I guess there's many other people that kind of fall in that category, but they sort of get the criticism from both sides. Yeah. And it's like, if I see someone post an anti-PETA article, I have to go, okay, let me check and see who this is coming from, because it could be, you know, someone that's just like, PETA PETA kills animals, and they're just like trying to pass that off as a way to be like, well, all vegans are hypocrites.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's coming from a vegan where they're like, PETA is sexist and racist. Yeah. And it's like they get it from both sides, which is, you know, really, I mean, I guess I'm not involved in other causes enough to know the ins and outs of the organizations that represent them, but I've never known, you know, an organization that was like the you know, the iconic group of a movement that is also just almost wholesale hated by its movement, which I know is not a fair classification. There's a lot of people that love PETA, but most of the people I associate with hate PETA so much.
Yeah. And it's, this is like off topic, but no, it's kind of on topic. I take back that statement. Edit that out. But it almost seems like same thing with Gary Yourofsky, that it's, they get so much criticism that you're kind of like, how could they not realize that they're doing something bad?
Yeah. Well, they all, you know, from what I've witnessed, it's people of this nature sort of all just brush it off as like, well, everyone's too sensitive, everyone's too PC, and I can't make a joke without offending someone in 2015. And you know, they're just sort of that mindset. They're like, well, everyone's too sensitive, but I'm working for the animals. And perhaps they might say the ends justify the means.
Yeah. But going back to what I was saying before, it's like, it would seem to me that they do enough stuff that like it seems to me like they would be doing enough stuff that wouldn't get criticism from like the vegan community, let's say, that they would be like, okay, like maybe we should focus on doing these things because at least one group of people is supporting us now. And I don't know, you would think that, I don't know. I guess it's hard. It's hard for us simple people to like think about
civilians.
To think about when you're that, like when you're that, I guess famous or something like that. How that changes your mindset and how you just kind of think, like everything that I do is right.
Well, they say absolute power corrupts absolutely, but I mean you see that in I don't want to harp on Yourofsky too much in this episode, but you see that in his videos where he's like, I am the educator. I am right. You're wrong. Fuck you. Yeah. He like says that without any ounce of irony in his voice. Like he's just like, I am right and you are wrong and I have logic on my side. And so whether that's who he is or whether that's he's in a spot where he's sort of built up and surrounded by all these people who are his yes, you know, people, you know, maybe it's a combination of both of those things or some third factor I'm not thinking of, but you get that. You see that in celebrity culture, and obviously not everyone that reaches that stratosphere is affected by it, but it's like kind of like, it's like a trope in like Hollywood and you know, you see that. It's a common enough thing that you could assume it's probably happening with these lower level vegan celebrities as well.
So I have a question for you. Do you think, because you've begrudgingly agreed that there are things that PETA do that, effectiveness aside, are not problematic, do you think that PETA could still be PETA and not do the things that both of us would say like, oh, that was like cringeworthy?
I feel like they could. I know that the nonprofit world is tricky because everyone's battling for donations, and there's, you know, a set amount of people that are going to donate to nonprofits and a set amount of people that are going to donate to animal or vegan or animal liberation, whatever nonprofits. And so they do a really good job of having the highest visibility. And I'm, you know, just guessing by their operating budget, they have a lot of donors, you know, small and as well as like bigger, you know, wealthier donors. So maybe if they didn't do those things that got the headlines and if they didn't have their logo on every goddamn protest sign that they have, they wouldn't be getting that money and they wouldn't be able to be the you know, mammoth organization that they are. Which, as a side note, whenever I see like people that get protest signs from PETA, I'm always kind of like, PETA has such a negative stigma, especially from people who are not vegan. that it seems like you wouldn't want their name associated with what you're doing at all. Because like PETA is just, everyone's like, PETA kills animals. PETA, you know, dog naps little dogs and kills them. And they want to, they don't want anyone to have any companion animal. All these things that people just like hate about them and view them as hypocrites. Mm-hmm. It feels like it would be worse. You know, it was like,
people would be more likely to just be immediately resistant of whatever you have to say.
Yeah, it was like, you know, when George W. Bush was ending his campaign and none of the Republican candidates wanted him to endorse them because they're like, no, it's okay. We don't want your name attached to this because no one likes you. It just, it feels like that. So that's just a, that's a tangent for you. A little bonus content.
So you think that they would not be as huge of an organization as they are now if they didn't do those things?
It's hard to say, because at the same time, it's hard for me to see those little stunts as actually accomplishing anything. Like, I know they say it's all about getting that 10-second soundbite on the news. Mm-hmm. But if that 10-second soundbite is, look how wacky PETA is, it's like, does that really do anything?
Well, according to the article, they have a impressive list of accomplishments throughout the years.
But like going through, I don't want to like read through everything right now, but a lot of those don't seem directly related to the flashy getting naked campaigns. Mm-hmm. So maybe that is to concede to your point that they, or I don't know if it was your point or your question, would they still be PETA without doing those things? And I think that they could mostly do that. I think they could still figure out media stunts that got attention that didn't employ sexism and racism and just all the isms.
Just wear biohazard suits all the time.
I know. Seriously. Maybe have a picturing a biohazard suit, but with like a butt flap hanging down.
Dang it, PETA.
Like, oh, finally, bodies are all covered up. Then they turn around. But it could be one of those plastic butts that people have for Halloween. So it's not, I don't know.
How deep can we go with this? But like you were, like you brought up the point, even though I said they have an impressive list of accomplishments, it's like, are those accomplishments coming from these stunts, or are they coming from like the just getting large numbers of people to protest, or like, I don't know, getting like petitions and stuff like that, that doesn't necessarily require people to be naked.
Does anything require people to be naked? You can have sex without getting showering? Naked. So I feel, oh, showering. All right. You win this time, Stellar.
Unless you were, some people probably wear bathing suits into the shower.
That's true. Never nude. No, yeah.
But, So the more that I think about it, I do think that like they could be maybe not as impactful, but they could be like still a very, very effective movement without doing the things that people have labeled as like, okay, that's racist, that's sexist, because not all the stuff they're doing is that.
When you say impactful, do you mean having an effect that helps animals, or just having more of a public visibility?
I think having the first one, like affecting an impact that affects animals, because maybe they wouldn't be as, what did you say? Maybe they wouldn't be as visible, but it's like you, like all of vegan advocacy isn't about like being visible. I feel like there are campaigns that are trying to get more vegans, which is very important. But then there are also campaigns to like end animal testing in like one specific location, you know, in like one town, they're like, or in one company. And it's like, you need numbers to sign petitions and stuff like that. But you don't, at that time, you don't necessarily need to be recruiting new people.
Yeah. I guess I just feel like if the things that get them more visibility can be deemed as not really having much of an impact in terms of making vegans, and Ingrid definitely claims credit for a couple of things, like the SeaWorld thing in here, even though I feel like a lot of that credit probably should go to Blackfish.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too.
If not most of it. But if those things that are getting more attention are the ones that are less effective, I think they could cut them out and still be just as impactful, being defined as helping more animals, if not more so, because again, if they're doing things that alienate people and sort of push them away from veganism, and it's like, you know, we all know that it's about the animals and you shouldn't not go vegan because you don't like certain vegans, but it's also this game of like breadcrumbs and like just like just coaxing, getting people to try a vegan cupcake. And, you know, so it's like knowing that that's part of the game. Like, I don't think you can just go, well, it shouldn't matter if a vegan wasn't nice to me. You should go vegan anyway. It's like, well, it's all part of this larger scheme that we're trying to do. So if their things are helping some animals somehow by having people wear a lettuce bikini in the short term, is it going to help animals in the long term if you're just sort of pushing people away? And because like right now, vegan is still an identity, and there's sort of this, for lack of a better word, cult of being obsessed with converting. And are you a vegan? Have you labeled yourself as vegan? Yeah. So right now it's very much like an identity. So if you're trying to get people to adopt that identity, not just be someone that's like, oh yeah, I'm for marriage equality and I'll vote for it on the ballot, you know, because obviously vegan requires more of an action than that. So if you're trying to get people to be open to sort of adopting that identity or the practices of it, do you want to be engaging in or elevating organizations or people, individuals, celebrities that are using tactics that are going to further alienate people?
Yeah. I feel like that's a very good summarize, like a closing statement that kind of captures everything that we've kind of been talking about.
Yeah. Although one thing I wanted to bring up.
Yes. All right.
I guess bring two things. The quote that I read from Ingrid earlier, it says, our guiding philosophy is that silence is a social cause's worst enemy, which I guess is sort of the all press is good press. Like there's no such thing as bad press. And I would argue that there is such a thing as bad press, especially in this arena where you're trying to open people's hearts and minds to stuff.
I don't think that PETA has created the stigma that vegans have, that like mainstream vegans have. I don't think PETA has created that, but it's somehow become synonymous. Like PETA has somehow become synonymous with that exact stigma. Like, oh, you're a vegan. Like, oh, you're one of those PETA advocates.
Yeah. There's at the very least, they're certainly not helping. But yeah, they're the ones that I think I've told this story before, but you know, when I went vegan and a family member was like, you going to be one of those PETA people? Or you, it's just people just like when I was doing outreach with 10 Billion Lives tour, people walk up, is this that PETA shit? Like, no? Okay, I'll watch it. You know, it's like people just have this totally negative.
Yeah.
And I'm always caught with people like, are you PETA? I usually have this like kind of guarded but cautious like, oh, no, we're not, you know, but kind of hinting towards like, oh, we're definitely not. Yeah. And like one time I had someone that I gave that and like, oh, well, PETA's awesome. And I was like, wait, what? How did that? You're the one, huh? Okay. You don't work for them. All right.
He like peeled off his mustache and it was Ingrid.
So, yeah. And then the final little line in Ingrid's article is things change when people take action, which, you know, we talk a lot about on effectiveness of various tactics. And I feel like that line is basically kind of just saying like doing something is better than doing nothing. But I don't always believe that that's true. I believe that there is damaging activism, and only history will bear out what is going to be the tactic or selection of tactics that actually achieve these goals. But I think that the doing something is better than doing nothing approach can be dangerous and can ultimately harm animals.
That this is kind of like a tangent, but in my classroom the other day, one kid said that expression, asking for forgiveness is easier than asking for permission. And everyone was like, oh yeah, yeah. And then one kid just was like, that saying is wrong. He was just like, that's not true at all. Like he was like, that applies to a very small selection of scenarios. And in most scenarios, it is not better to ask for permission or to ask for forgiveness than to ask for permission. You're just being a terrible person if you did that. And I was like, whoa, you're right. There's like a very small selection of scenarios in which asking for forgiveness would be better than asking for permission. But Yeah, that just reminded me of that. Yeah. It doesn't really relate, but I guess it's it relates in that it's another saying that when you think about it, you're like, maybe this isn't true.
It's just some of the flavor that makes people tune into this podcast, Paul.
Yeah.
All right. Well, okay. I think we could leave it there. Again, all the links to the articles we have been talking about can be found on the show notes, and we'll tell you where you can find those when we take a break. And after the break, we will come back with an interview with Holly Knoll, who has a ton of credits to her name, one of which is Vegan Powerlifter. And we do a little follow-up on episode 15, where we talked about the use of masculinity to promote veganism and vegan bodybuilding and all of those things. So it's definitely a really interesting conversation. So
stick around.
All right, we'll be right back.
So we're going to take a quick break from episode 17 to tell you about The Commentist.
What?
Yes. TheCommentist.com, the place where you can find The Bearded Vegans and a bunch of other great podcasts. So you can check out TheCommentist.com at TheCommentist.com.
Wait, hold on. You can't just fly through a word like that without spelling it for the listeners.
TheCommentist.com. TheCommentist.com.
You can leave us hanging and not spell .com?
DOTCOM. So, The Commentist, you can check out a lot of other great podcasts. There's Kiss the Crest, that's a soccer podcast. There's Roll to Hit, that's a Dungeons and Dragons podcast that I also do. And I will say, I've never mentioned this on the podcast, on this podcast before, but in the Dungeons and Dragons podcast for the first season that I was the Dungeon Master, I inserted a lot of little vegan stuff every once in a while. So, if that's your flavor, then go take a listen to that.
Go pick up those vegan Easter eggs.
Yep. And
Veg Easter eggs.
And while you're at it, while you're downloading all those other podcasts, you can get on iTunes and Stitcher. Also, if you're on iTunes, make sure to rate and review us and leave us a comment if you want. And that would be very, very helpful.
Yeah, it helps us expand our audience. So if you like what we're talking about, that's the number one thing you can do aside from throw money at our faces. But there's no way to do that right now. So comment and leave a rating.
All right. Thank you, Andy. And let's get back to the show.
Our guest today is Holly Knoll, who has a ton of credits to her name, but most recently the owner of Plant Fit in Oakland, co-host of the Rise and Resist podcast, creator of Fit Quick, and vegan powerlifter. Holly, welcome to the show.
Thanks!
So excited to have you on, especially because we've been talking a lot about the vegan fitness community in previous episodes, and it's great to have someone that has firsthand experience and all that to comment on it. But before we dive into that, just want to find out, you know, how you got to where you are right now. So what came first for you? Was it veganism? Was it fitness? Was there something else that was your main passion? How did you, you know, start this journey?
It all started with punk rock when I was like a kid, and my family got me into it. I was with my brother, who was a skater and into punk rock. My mom was giving me sort of like Green Day and Rancid tapes when I was a kid. So that was pretty cool, but it wasn't really, oddly, until 9/11 of all things that I really took a second to like question all there was around me. And it made me really dive into like all the politics that were in like the punk rock records I was listening to. And I started getting into like more of an anarchist perspective and theories around like more egalitarian societies. And that led me to basically being in like a co-op in San Francisco. And I was waiting for somebody to pick me up. And so I was sort of walking around and like reading zines and books that were around, because I don't remember why they were late, but they were obviously late. And I remember picking up a zine, which for those who don't know is just like basically a DIY magazine. They're usually pretty small and self-printed. And there was just like a very short little article about the connection between feminism and veganism. And I was vegetarian at the time, but I sort of didn't see a reason to become vegan, because I had never really like I didn't have any idea what was going on in the dairy and egg industry. And as far as I could see, it was like that sort of surface perspective, like, well, I'm not eating somebody else very obviously, so I think I'm doing pretty good. And at that time, I was actually teaching as part of a program in San Francisco how to end domestic violence and help people avoid like date rape situations and build healthier relationships. So I was pretty deep up in the egalitarian feminist sort of perspective on things. And I remember reading it and being like, shit, I am very, very hypocritical right now. I definitely need to change this in my life. And you know, I went vegan right then and there, and it's been the exact same always. I have this sort of tendency towards being very much who I am. And then once I decide to commit to something, I commit to it, you know, kind of forever.
Right on. And so at what point did the fitness community sort of enter your life?
The fitness part, I started working out, maybe about 6 years ago. I describe it as tripping and stumbling through fitness. I sort of started working out because I was living in Seattle at the time. And I'm from California, and just in case somebody's living under a rock, Seattle's really, really dark, cold, and rainy, which is not my natural environment. And so I actually started working out, which sounds kind of sad because it was warm. The people at the desk at least knew my name, and it was well lit. And when you do, like, when you move around, generally you feel happier. From a hormonal perspective and a chemical perspective, you release things into your body that make you feel happier. But also just moving around makes you feel, you know, just generally better. And so I started just sort of like going to the gym and like being on a treadmill or using machines. And then I just sort of caught the bug and started getting more into it for about a year or so, and trying to just like try new things and try to do it without a whole lot of judgment on myself for kind of sucking at everything. And I found CrossFit, which I found really, really, really cool because there was like a new representation of women in fitness. And that representation was not like a Nike commercial, where like everyone's a size zero and they're running and they're quiet and they're perfectly lit and they have lots of makeup on. It was like these women who have like, you know, defined abs and big shoulders, and they're like moving serious weight and they're grunting and they're not necessarily worrying about being pretty. And I like gravitated towards that. I was like, okay, cool. Like these people are like, they're strong, they're badass. And in the sport, they're held to the same standards as guys, which I also thought was really cool because most sports in our society are like, when was the last time you saw a women's basketball game, like during prime time? Like it just doesn't happen. And that always turned me off to so many things about athletics. And like, I don't want to be the marginalized one. And in CrossFit, it was held up. But the thing that I didn't like about CrossFit is I'm not very fast. Like I had asthma my whole life, and once I went vegan, I sort of started to get over it. But in CrossFit, you sort of have to move quickly and efficiently and sort of have what they call an engine. And what I found was I would be doing all these like burpees or thrusters or pull-ups, and then I'd get to like a heavy deadlift, for instance, or like a heavy squat, and I was like, man, I could be so much stronger if I didn't do all that conditioning before this. That's sort of how I landed on powerlifting. I was like, I'll just stop doing all that together and I'll just sort of, you know, eat lots of awesome food and try and lift heavy weight and be stoked about it. And so that's sort of how I ended up here. But I think it's definitely worth noting that so Ed, my partner, is a champion bodybuilder, and he was in the more aesthetic parts of fitness before I met him. And the first year of Plant Built was the first time I ever went to sort of like a fitness conference or gathering of any kind, and it was quite big. And to be perfectly honest, I had a pretty negative reaction to it. I kind of was reflecting on it when you asked me to be on this podcast, because I was like, the first time I ever was in a large bodybuilding conference, I had never seen anything like that. I was just into working out because it felt good. And all of a sudden I was in this, like, everyone's got spray tans and they've got these like special, you know, tiny bathing suit things, and they're all depleted and sort of unhappy. And or what I perceive to be unhappy, because people don't necessarily feel their best when they're getting read on stage, but they do love what they do, and my team definitely loves what they do. But I sort of had like a little bit of emotional breakdown, like, if I never want to be somebody who's in like a sparkly bikini and like very, very lean and on stage, like, where do I belong here? Which I think is something that a lot of people can relate to. So I came out of that with this, like, okay, I really need to reflect and like, is this where I want to be? And I'm kind of glad that that ended up happening, even though it felt very stressful at the time, because it sort of led me to be where I am now. And that's that, like, we have this really awesome gym and we can promote a really body positive message where everyone feels included. If you want to be like that person who's dehydrated and fake tanned, getting on stage looking how you want, like, you can be that. Or you can be someone who just lifts heavy weight and isn't worried about definition, and you can be that person too. Or you can be whatever the fuck you want to be. And I think that that's a part of fitness that is, I'm not going to say underrepresented, but definitely something that, like, we could use more of.
Absolutely. And I listened to Giacomo and Danny's podcast, Muscles by Brussels, and following their journey, where they're talking about all the negative stuff of dehydrating and just feeling miserable as you're preparing for competition. As someone who's not in that world, it's just kind of really interesting to hear all those negative side effects. And it's not something you hear a lot of people in the fitness community really talking about, although obviously, you know, bodybuilding for these competitions is different than what the average person is trying to do. Mm-hmm. But so that kind of segues into, you know, some of the topics we've talked about in previous shows. And I really love the way that you do approach fitness. And like you just said, you can be whatever the fuck you want to be. It doesn't have to be this one thing. And two episodes ago, episode 15, we used something that the Vegan Bros posted that was very sexist and misogynist to have a springboard for a discussion about, you know, how sexism is very much ingrained in a lot of mainstream organizations' promotion of veganism. And through that, we came to this article on the Vegan Feminist Network, which was entitled "Vegan Bodybuilders, Muscle Men, and the Masculine Physique: Why Promoting the Masculine is Harmful to the Animal Liberation Movement." And the overall gist of the article is that, you know, when groups like Vegan Outreach, which is just who they used as an example, use images of bodybuilders to promote veganism, it's harmful because it's linked to masculinity, and masculinity is responsible for so much violence against women. And Paul and I talked about it briefly, and we had our overall assessment, but we're also kind of hesitant to talk about it because we're both men and it's something that affects us differently than women. So it's one of the main reasons why I wanted to have you on, was to get your perspective. So what was sort of your initial reaction when you read the article?
You know, my initial reaction to the article is sort of, I guess, resistance, because the feeling that I get from it is very sort of second wave feminist. And I'm always sort of, I question that for a variety of reasons. I don't like the idea that we have to erase everything to create something that isn't elitist. I think a lot of people feel, you know, it's, I hope people don't get mad about this, but like, some people feel very comfortable in whatever version of masculinity that they have. And I don't think you have to tear down all versions of masculinity to create a movement or society that's positive. I think that, like, representing like the masculine in a way that has compassion and that isn't predatorial, that isn't harmful, is a really good idea. And I think just attacking anything that looks masculine because it could be harmful is pretty negative. I think that there's a lot of, ironically, the men in the vegan bodybuilding movement that represented in the article is Robert Cheek. I'm close with Robert Cheek. He's so compassionate and so gentle and so great. And just as two other examples of, like, very masculine people in our movement who definitely have pictures out there looking like bulgy and muscly and super masculine, and who are very, very gentle and definitely changing what it means to be masculine, are like my partner Ed and Giacomo of Vegan Proteins. Like, you know, definitely representing that classic masculine standard, which is what they're looking for in bodybuilding. And that's how they succeed in that fitness world, which is unfortunate in and of itself. But I know that they have chosen the version of masculine that they want to be, and they're representing that with like compassion and without all of the, without all the negatives that exist in sort of the social, really boxed in version of what it means to be masculine. And I really appreciate people who are fighting that and saying like, you know, I'm going to choose what I want and go with it. And I think that that's the kind of thing, in my opinion, that's going to create a society and a movement that's better, are people who are of the privileged class of folks, who are sort of stepping down from that and being like, I choose what I want. I'm going to use what privilege I have to like sort of push the people I think are awesome, who are maybe not being represented, to the forefront and be a little quieter and be an ally or whatever they choose to do. I think that that's really good. And I think it's good that people who want to be, who feel very comfortable in the binary gender system, I think it's important for them to be who they want, just like I think it's important to break down that gender binary system as not all that exists. And any guy who wants to be his own version of whatever it means to be a guy can do that. And if you don't even want to be a guy, then be whatever the fuck you want. And I don't think that anything should be privileged. And I think that that's what creates the oppression, not necessarily what they feel like they want to be. I hope that that wasn't too run around you.
No, I mean, it's all, it's a, I feel like there's a lot of nuance to the discussion.
Absolutely.
And that's what we're trying to get at here. And actually something, as I was reading it again to prepare for the interview, it made me question if muscular bodies are inherently masculine, because it seems like the article is just sort of having a problem with having photos of muscular bodies. And I think you were kind of getting at this, that maybe if that's the only thing that you promote, then that's a problem. But if it's just sort of maybe part of the spectrum of, hey, this is possible. Just like for me, I think it's important to promote the fact that there are fat vegans out there, or there are very skinny vegans, and that that's going to be good, because not everyone's going to be a bodybuilder. Not everyone's going to be super skinny. Not everyone's going to be fat. So it's like, okay, wherever you're at, it shows that you can be vegan. So
yeah, there's nothing wrong with anything. Like, if you want to work out and look a certain way, work out and look a certain way. If you want to eat tons of delicious tofurky Hot Pockets like myself, fucking do that and don't have to find abs. Like, you know, like, I feel like it's totally okay to be whatever. And it's just, it just becomes not okay when that's the only thing that's important. But I just want to like touch on what you just said, and that's that men naturally grow bigger than women. It's not like oppressive, right? Just if you are a guy, generally you're likely to be larger, even if you don't work out, than the women around you. It's a hormonal thing, and it's not oppressive. It's not anything. It can be used to be oppressive, of course, because anybody who is larger or stronger or whatever has the physical ability to be oppressive. But if you don't use that to be oppressive, then it's not naturally oppressive. Like, I can work out just as hard, like, as a guy right next to me, and because of hormone profiles, I just won't build the same type of muscle. I won't get big and bulgy the same way, which is why it's always entertaining when people are afraid of the whole getting bulky thing, which is a whole new bag of worms. But, but like, I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with that. And in the article, they basically say that the size and mass and muscle is what creates male sexual assault. And I think that's so trapping, because, you know, it's not a guy's fault. A guy isn't a rapist if he's 6'4" and like just naturally like broad. That doesn't make them like somebody who's going to assault anyone.
Yeah, it seems like maybe the article is sort of conflating muscular bodies with masculinity, which obviously masculinity is so much more than the body that you have. It's this whole system of all these, you know, millions of factors that all sort of play into, like you were talking about, gender roles and all that stuff. So I think, yeah, now that we're sort of fleshing it out, I think that's sort of what struck me as odd about the article, was that it was just saying that inherently, if you have this type of body, that it's oppressive to promote it with veganism.
Exactly, which in itself is a little bit backwards, because, like, if you just happen to be of a type of body, or you just naturally gravitate towards doing that, like, that doesn't make you bad, and there shouldn't be no representation of that body type. I think it just gets sketchy when those are the only types of bodies that are represented, which I definitely have a problem with. I think that, especially in social media, it's generally acceptable to only represent very lean, smaller, very sort of heteronormative versions of bodies, whether it's like a lady who's like a smaller, leaner, maybe more muscular version of what would have been represented 10 years ago. They're still smaller, and they're still pretty, and they still have lots of makeup on. And there's like these versions of guys who have this perfect V taper and like all this defined everything and striations. And like, I think it gets uncomfortable for me when those are the only things that are represented, that it's only guy, girl, small, lean, muscular, whatever. And just like what you said, like, I think there are people of all types of bodies in fitness. There are all types of people of bodies, different bodies and different genders in veganism. And I think it's really important to represent everybody and not just represent one version. And, you know, fuck, man, I don't know how to change those things. I don't know how to make it so that, like, those vegan Fitspro Instagram sites don't just represent one thing. But I do think it's important to, like, speak out and say, like, everyone's welcome. Like, do your shit. But I think it's important not to, like, say that you can't be masculine, you can't be feminine. I think that is trapping, just the same as saying you have to be feminine, you have to be masculine.
Absolutely. And you were talking about these compassionate, muscular men who are working to sort of change the stereotype of what that, you know, visually masculine body is capable of in terms of being compassionate to others. And that is not to say, of course, that there are not plenty of vegan fitness, bodybuilding, or otherwise figureheads who are not doing that. And that's something we're going to be talking about. Well, we're recording this interview now. The actual show is going to be recorded later. But we will be talking about Durian Ryder and Freely.
Oh, fuck me.
And
vegan.
So
that's one of the things on my to-do list to put in social media day, because it's... I've had a problem with the Freely version of what it means to be healthy for a long time, but I don't know what the hell Durian's doing out there, because I really hope people just tear that guy down from a pedestal and just put him somewhere outside of the spotlight. But unfortunately, those types of drama usually get people more attention as opposed to less.
Yeah, it seems like those three in particular, Durian, Freely, and Vegan Gains. Are you familiar with Vegan Gains?
Everyone talks about Vegan Gains. I searched it the other day and I can't find it. But I called Giacomo of Vegan Proteins before this interview just to be like, hey, can I run a couple things past you? Just to talk about it and sort of flesh out my own opinions on things. And he was like, you know, people like Durian and Vegan Gains are a different breed, and it's really offensive that we're put in the same category as them. And I'm like, damn it, I need to find this Vegan Gains guy, because I don't have any idea what they're putting out there. And for some reason, I just missed the boat on that oppressive figurehead.
Well, you're definitely better off not having seen any of his stuff. He has a YouTube channel where basically he sort of is just there calling out other bodybuilders for the most part, and a lot of them are not vegan, so he sort of uses it as his way to promote veganism. I haven't watched any of his videos in quite a long time, since he kind of burst on the scene, I think, just earlier this year. But it's sort of similar. Like, I see Freely and Durian, one of their main things that they like to do is sort of post people that they see in public, and this mm-hmm. person's fat, and if they were just doing this, then they would have this type of body instead. So, it is offensive that, you know, that you're sort of under the same umbrella. I think it's offensive, and as a vegan in general, that they're out there and that they do seem to gain so much traction, maybe just by virtue of creating so much drama and conflict, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have a problem with that, and the Freely version of it, I think, is offensive for a couple of reasons. I don't think that there's anything wrong with any type of body as long as you are stoked on that type of body, or you're working to be stoked on that, because I think it's wrong to have to live in a skin that you don't like. But I just from a nutritional perspective, the type of food that is promoted by Freely, in a lot of clients that I've had, actually caused the opposite. She and they put out sort of like this vision of like, it's raw, it's bad. I used to be this ugly, evil version of myself, and she looked totally normal. Not wrong in any way. She didn't look like a Disney villain or anything. And then she eats this like sort of high carb diet, which works, you know, it appears to be working for her. But that like, if you eat this, then you'll get this result. Like, bodies are different, man. Bodies, like, they react to lots of different things, and saying that there's only one way, that's a really popular way to be. And it's a really fucked way to be, because different bodies react to different things, and you have to find different ways. And if you say this is the only way and it doesn't work for you, like, how do you feel? It feels terrible.
Yeah, and if people think that there's only this one way to be vegan and they try it and it doesn't work for them, then obviously that's not going to do any good for the animals. If they try it and they don't lose the weight or they don't get that body, and then, you know, they're like, well, I guess I'll just go back to eating animals and causing all this other harm because this one specific, you know, eating 20 bananas a meal wasn't working for me.
Exactly. And from like just a physiological perspective, like, a certain amount of fat is what regulates hormones in your body. So, I mean, if it works for you, then it works for you, and like, keep on doing you. But I can't figure out how your body would work really well without any fat in your diet. So I just don't think that that's terribly healthy. So I don't like that. But the other thing that I wanted to touch on is that different bodies are attractive to different people. And like, my personal opinion of her physical state is that she looked better before she got super skinny and couldn't wear shirts that didn't show her midsection. Like, I don't want to be that super, super tiny, like, very, very lean version. Like, I want to be big and strong. Like, I look up to Bane and of Batman. And, like, I'm not trying to grab that super lean body that has like no body fat on it. That's just not what I'm working towards. And I think that the perspective of like, oh, I was so horrible looking when I looked more like most of the population it's a really fucked up way to be. But I definitely don't want to get in a tangent that makes everybody think a lot about Freely and Durian. So let's just forget about Freely and Durian and hope that they are a fleeting part of our movement. But I do want to touch on something that you sort of touched on, and that's that we don't live. I always say this. I hope people don't get offended by this, but we don't live in like a sweet egalitarian society where everybody is trying to create an openness for everybody else. Like, we live in a pretty oppressive society that's pretty damn patriarchal, and like, we are still trying to create a state where animals aren't getting oppressed. And I know that like quote normies or non activist types that have like zero toe in the foundation or in the fountain of like knowledge and building like that sort of more open egalitarian version of what we want, they're just living their lives, and they can be changed and moved by these images of maybe what they're looking to change their bodies to look like. And yes, that is an overrepresentation of what it is to be in the vegan movement right now. Yes, I think that that's pretty oppressive, and yes, I wish that there was more representation, and I'm trying to put out more representation of more people who are strong, awesome, fat, skinny, ripped, not ripped, whatever. But I think I really think it's always very important to sort of check your ego and be like, is it more important that I let these smaller things in our movement and my morality about those things like sort of make me break down all the diversity of tactics that are not exactly what I think is right. Because, like, in the end, if that picture of Robert Cheek, for instance, changes a chunk of the population, then that's a chunk of the population that is not actively promoting animals being raped daily, animals watching their families be slaughtered, animals watching their babies get ripped away just to, like, get into another rape situation and produce another baby that gets ripped away. And, like, I think people get so caught up in sort of, like, the morality of it. And I do agree that, like, what we're trying to move towards is not just a vegan world. It's a world that people don't feel the need to oppress others. And, you know, I'm definitely don't come up on the winning end of that patriarchal society all the time. And I've definitely felt the full brunt of what it means to not come up on the winning side of it. But I think it's important to step back and be like, if I am that like mom cow who's dealing with that, do I fucking care about Durian Ryder? I don't. Like, I just care that I'm not getting raped every day. And, like, fuck, man, that's a rough thing to say. Like, it's important to step back and be like, what changes people? Let's change people while moving towards something better. And I also think it's important not to just attack people for having a perspective that isn't yours. I think there's a lot of public attack, especially on the internet, like what we're talking about with Freely. Like, I don't think it's good to just publicly attack people when they say something wrong. Like, I think it's a good idea to, like, message people privately and be like, hey, do you know what you're saying is offensive? And, like, with those two, I know that they think it's offensive, but with other people in our society, like, maybe they just haven't realized that it's offensive yet, and maybe they haven't realized that what they're doing is oppressive, and maybe they'll change without being attacked.
Yeah, I think that everything you just said, there's sort of like a line to walk between what do you let slide and what is too big of an offense that you sort of have to address it. And
totally,
certainly agree that we're big fans on the show of having conversations with people, and that's sort of our preferred method of outreach, not the sort of yelling at people and all that. And it's tough because. I guess to me, it's kind of like the animals don't care why someone is vegan, but also if it's like someone that's going vegan and they're going to sort of replicate what some of these problematic figureheads are doing, is that going to drive certain people away from the movement? Is that going to prevent certain people from going vegan? If we have a vegan movement that's championing people that are, you know, shouting down certain body types or shouting down people of color, or, you know, sexist or whatever it might be, is that ultimately going to push more people away from veganism? So it's, I don't know, it's, I, you know, like you said, I don't have the answers to all this stuff, but it's a tricky line to walk to know when is the appropriate time to sort of call something out or call someone in, and when is it okay to just go, you know what, this is just sort of a smaller thing and it's okay for me to let this slide.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I do think that it's also worth noting that, like, a lot of those guys in those versions of what it means to be masculine, they are sort of put up as just a set of abs and, like, a bigger chest. Like, they're being torn apart just the same as other people. Like, that picture of Robert Cheek, for instance, like, his face wasn't there. There was no quote from him. It was just like, look at my shoulders. They have lots of veins. And, like, I think that that is unfair. Like, I think that that representation of those people is not representation of what they're trying to put out in the world necessarily. It's just a fucking picture. And it's just a picture of somebody who happens to be doing a lot of curls, which puts a lot of blood in your muscles and makes you more bulgy. That's not inherently wrong. That's not inherently anything. And I think that everybody should be able to be like sort of a brain attached to whatever body you have.
Yeah, I think that's important. It's like, yeah, what body they have, but then also what's coming out of their mouth. What are they actually promoting? And that's something that's obviously missed when you just have a picture of a person. Then people people can apply whatever they want to that image if there's no sort of context or quote that's attached to it. But what were you gonna say?
Oh, yeah, I think that's exactly true. And I think that a lot of times, communities that I've been a part of, they are, communities seem to be pretty quick to judge. I think that, people sort of get on their sort of very closed in high horse and get very attached to their own opinions, and are very willing to sort of put out their sort of negative, representations or quotes or discussions of other people's opinions. And I think that that can be very dangerous. I think that that in and of itself can fissure communities in a way that people don't really take into account, I think, a lot of the time. It's very harmful to say that if you say something wrong, you're going to be put on blast all over the internet and your life is going to feel totally fucked. People should be able to be forgiven. People should be able to grow and learn. And we all came from the patriarchal society and we're all at our different versions of growth. And no, it's not okay to be offensive. And yes, I think that the vegan bros, like, sexist version of what it means to be vegan is often pretty fucked up. And I think that there's definitely, you have to draw a line. Like, you can't just be like, oh, that guy's, you know, he's vegan, he's compassionate, so it's okay that he's doing all these awful things. Like, no, that's not okay. But it makes people afraid to speak out. It makes people afraid to be authentically themselves if they're worried about being the next person who is put in the spotlight in a negative way and torn down on the internet. I think that sometimes it can come off as sort of a version of bullying. And I do think that we should talk about things, but I think we should be really careful about specifically targeting people and saying they represent something if you don't know.
Fair enough. Well, I think that's probably a good place to leave off that conversation, unless you had anything else to add.
I guess what I want to leave it at is that, like, I definitely get it. Like, I am the survivor of multiple negative experiences. Like, I face down being prey in a society that teaches people to be predators every single day. But, like, I want to challenge the idea that, like, masculinity itself and muscle itself or whatever is being representative of what we're discussing, like, that in and of itself is to blame. I think it's important to consider that changing the ideas of what it means to be masculine or tearing down the idea of that masculine means you have to be overly aggressive or predatorial, and saying you can be whatever you want if you're smaller, stronger, larger, more muscle, less muscle, more bulgy, less bulgy, small, whatever, that you should be driven to do whatever the fuck you want and represent what you believe as strongly as you can and try to change the world in whatever way that you can, no matter what you look like. A diversity of tactics is what is important, as long as it's not limiting somebody and making it so that they don't feel like they can be their authentic self as well.
All right. Very well said. So let's just wrap it up. I just wanted to talk to you briefly or just ask about the Rise and Resist podcast and
Oh yeah.
You know, if you could tell our listeners what that is and why did you decide to start it?
Yeah, so Rise and Resist is a podcast that I do with another really awesome lady named Lacey Davis, and we started it because we felt like there were a lot of things in fitness and in vegan fitness specifically, but just in fitness in general, that isn't being talked about. It was kind of inspired by somebody who does strong man, so she's a strong lady, and talking about how people react to her being bigger and still being stronger, and we just sort of like just started talking about things that we felt like weren't being talked about, and I guess it kind of struck a chord and people sort of reacted to it, and we kept finding more things we wanted to talk about, and it kind of just turned into a thing. It began just sitting in my apartment with like my old punk rock mic wrapped up in blankets between us. So if you listen to the first few episodes, apologies for the sound quality. But yeah, we're just kind of trying to open up discussion and talk about things that need to be talked about that aren't really out there and maybe make a dent in changing what it means to be fit and healthy and stoked.
Awesome. Yeah. And so you're 29 episodes deep right now by my count. So if people are enjoying this conversation, definitely go check out Rise and Resist. and then this, the one last thing I just wanted to let people know about is, so you created FitQuick, is that correct?
Yeah. I created FitQuick because I was posting pictures of, I was trying to get leaner for photo shoots a couple of years back, and I was posting pictures of, protein waffles, and people were like, I want to make those. So I'd send recipes, and people were, they just weren't coming out right. And they were like, hey, can you just send me some of your mix? And so it kind of just came out of kind of Instagram, honestly. And it's just been growing and blowing up ever since. I created FitQuick, and, even though he will not take credit for it, I consider it mostly mine, but also partially my partner's, because he does all the branding, all of the media, all of my labels, and pretty much all of the face of FitQuick. So I quit created it, and then there's two more really awesome flavors that are coming out that I'm super excited about very soon.
Can you reveal what those flavors are? Is it secret?
It's not secret. Okay, so, but this will be the first time I say it in public. So,
all right.
Hi, listeners. Now you know cool things about FitQuick. So there's going to be two new flavors. They're birthday cake, which I finally found awesome vegan sprinkles that are bright and colorful and great. So there's going to be that, and the label for that I'm just so stoked on. It's very different from the other labels, and it's a charging robot unicorn, which is the coolest thing ever to me. And then there's also going to be a dark chocolate raspberry flavor. And FitQuick is a high protein, high fiber, lower carb, lower fat, just waffle mix that all you have to do is add like non-dairy milk and mix it up and, you know, eat waffles and get stoked. There's a bunch of flavors including FitQuick. So, or including pizza FitQuick, which is, yeah, I have one flavor that's that. I want to make a burrito one, but I don't think people seem that stoked on it. So those are the two flavors that are about to come out, but those two flavors are also going to be released in a protein donut formula.
Ooh.
That's going to be pretty limited, so pretty excited for that to come out. I'm just waiting for all the labels and stuff to come through. It's amazing how long it takes to get an idea to turn into an actual thing, which I'm sure you know about with Compassion.
Oh, yeah. Very cool. And so if people want to pick some of that up, veganproteins.com, that's the best place for it, right?
Yeah, that's my distributor, and they're amazing and wonderful and great. You can get it there, or you can come to the gym in Oakland if you happen to be local or maybe passing through.
Right on. And so what are the best ways for people to follow you and your journey or connect with you and social media and all that good stuff? What's your preferred outlet?
Yeah, so the easiest way to connect with me in public view is Instagram. I post everything to Instagram. As long as you don't have a problem with cute puppy pictures, then my Instagram's great for you. So it's at XVXH. And if you're local to the Bay Area, you can hit me up at hollyplantfit@gmail.com and come hang out at our gym. That's always a fun way to do it. And if you're not local, you can also use that email address to just hit me up and say hi.
Right on. Well, Holly, thank you so much for joining. It's been a really interesting conversation.
Thank you so much for having me on. I feel super honored that I'm on your podcast. I'm like, ah, I've been looking up to you. You're like a hero in the movement. You've been around for a long time. So I'm like, I feel super stoked and super honored that you wanted to have me on. And I'm also really glad that you're sort of breaking open things that need to be broken open and being really honest and open. I'm psyched on what you're doing, too.
Cool. Well, you're making me feel very bashful right now, but thank you. Thank you for the kind words, and thanks again for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks.
Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that that interview with Holly Knoll. So we got a bunch of cool we don't got a bunch of cool stuff. We basically got one cool thing coming up, and now it's basically half of us have one cool thing coming up. What is this thing that I'm talking about, Andy?
If you're listening to this the day it comes out, or maybe the day after, December 19th in New York City at the V Spot, there is a holiday market. So if you're scrambling and you're like, I'm vegan and I need to buy stuff for my vegan friends, or I need to give vegan presents to non-vegan friends. Come down. There's baked goods. There's soaps and candles. I will have all your t-shirts. And you can grab food from V-Spot, and there's a bunch of other vendors. Paul will not be there, as promised in the previous episode, because there's some tiny film coming out that Paul's going to go see.
Yes, you can't see me right now, but I'm making a very pouty face. I had double booked myself. I didn't realize that I had already been given tickets as like a birthday. The birthday of Jesus. I'd already been given Christmas gifts that was like tickets to go see the new Star Wars movie, and it's the same day.
I mean, I understand, because you'll have literally no other opportunity to see Star Wars, so gotta take advantage.
But I'm really bummed. Sorry, Beardos, to disappoint you. But you'll get to see Andy, and that's better anyways. Yeah. So
if you want to come eat at Superiority Burger afterwards with me, come on down.
Dang it. And what you just said about getting gifts for people, I'm like, oh man, I still need to get gifts for people, and that would have been perfect.
You know, the greatest gift of all is your presence.
That's why they call it the present. I don't know if that was a different phrase. That might have been two expressions put into one.
All right.
All right. I think that's all we have for today. We are the Bearded Vegans, signing off. If we really want that. I guess it's like, I'm not like dying to get free pickles. I'm not dying to get free pickles, but please send us some pickles.